When you were a teenager, did you want to be seen and perceived as cool? I sure did. In today's youth culture, the concept of cool is what drives fads, trends, and purchases. In fact, marketers are all about capturing, mass-producing, and selling cool. But can cool become a hindrance to spiritual growth? Can it become an idol that consumes our lives? Today, we're engaging in a lively and informative discussion of cool fads and trends on this special Pumpkin Spice, remember it's fall and Pumpkin Spice is trendy, episode of Youth Culture Matters.
From the Center for Parent Youth Understanding, this is Youth Culture Matters. If you're a parent, youth worker, educator, counselor, grandparent, or anyone else who cares about kids, we're glad you've joined us for this practical, informative, and hope-filled podcast. This is a place where together we talk and think Christianly about the rapidly changing world of today's children, teens, and young adults.
Welcome to Youth Culture Matters, everybody. I'm Walt Mueller from the Center for Parent Youth Understanding. Jason, welcome. This is episode 20. We've done 20.
Are you
this
serious?
Is the 20th podcast we've recorded.
Wow. 20 happy episodes This Youth Culture Matters. I love it.
You know what? And it's really not that monumental because I was thinking, you know, the guy said this is episode 20. Episode 100 will be something significant, but for right now, this is good. Episode 20.
Well,
I'm pretty happy we've been able to do this.
100 should be epic. 50 should be worth something.
Oh, yeah.
But 100 should be pretty epic. But, hey, I didn't think we'd make it to 10. So what do I know? I mean, we're at 20. This is awesome.
Why did you think that? What were you thinking?
I don't know.
You're just making that up to fill time, aren't you?
I am. No, okay.
I know it's because you're a Cubs fan. That's why that is. You're just not optimistic about anything.
Well,
we're getting there.
I had to switch my pessimism to another arena because this year the Cubs are so good that I just don't know where to place.
So you're not
my
satisfied
skepticism.
You're not satisfied just moving your pessimism over into your NFL team.
Oh no, that one I've just given up on.
Okay, all right.
The Bears are worth just giving up on. So yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Well,
all right. Well, this is good. I'm pretty excited because this particular podcast, to stay in step with everything that's cool, everything that's out there that's trendsetting right there, this is our Pumpkin Spice podcast.
Oh, that's I just feel like I'm standing in line at a Starbucks right now. This is awesome.
Explain that. Say, oh, pumpkin spice latte.
Pumpkin spice latte.
That's where it all started, isn't it?
Pumpkin spice. It's definitely where it started.
And
I
you
mean,
were...
maybe a listener will actually say, no, it actually started here. It may have, but the thing I most associate it with is Starbucks.
And
releasing it in August.
Of? Do you remember what year they
released it?
I did some research on this. I think it was 2011, right? 2011 is when they released, and when they first rolled out the pumpkin spice latte. Is that accurate?
Is it?
You guys check that out.
No.
See,
I think
it would have been a lot sooner
because I worked for Starbucks a long time ago in a land far, far away. But I worked for Starbucks way back when, and this would have been in the early 2000s.
It's that old. Okay.
Yeah, and they had the pumpkin spice latte then. I mean, I will say that it legitimately was only here for a very short period of time. So it would be released sometime in late September and only through October into early November, and then it would disappear again.
Yeah.
And people would legitimately cry because we no longer had it.
Yeah.
It was one of those things that was really, really bad.
Well, now that's – people would come into Starbucks crying because you didn't have that?
Yeah, they would. You know, it's just one of those things. They would be crying, and so.
Oh, yeah. kind of like your son right now, who just walked into the room.
Yeah, just like my son, who
decided
to
pumpkin
hop
spice
on the podcast
latte daddy,
this
morning. All right, great, good.
Yeah,
good.
So we just fact checked for you, and pumpkin spice latte.
Wait a minute, how did you say that?
Pumpkin spice
latte. Oh, you said pumpkin. I thought you said pumpkin.
I say that now and then.
All right, okay.
That is probably fair. They started developing this latte in 2003.
Oh, 2003.
And then,
oh,
actually, in the fall of 2003, actually not where you are, in D.C. and Vancouver, they actually started testing it there and selling it. Then, as of 2008 to 2012, sales increased by 234%. So it went big around then.
And, Kent, why don't you tell everybody? Well, I'll tell them. It actually didn't have any pumpkin in it, did it, originally?
It
was
not.
All just spices.
Right.
So it was a big ruse.
You could say that.
Yeah. I tell you, the Starbucks manipulation is unbelievable. I have just...
Actually, they claim that there is actually pumpkin puree in the ingredients.
Well, they added that. I saw that. They added that later. But yeah, think about all the things.
Came later.
Think about all the things that are with pumpkin spice right now. You know, I was out with Lisa yesterday, and we were in Target, and I was waiting for her, and I was up in the, I don't know, what do you call it? It was like where all the soap and the cosmetics and all up towards the front, and I just started to look. What can you find that's pumpkin spice? I actually found Burt's Bees has a pumpkin spice lip balm. I found a dog food that had pumpkin in it. They're selling it. And you know that the dog food company.
They have
that,
a dog food with
pumpkin?
Yeah,
with pumpkin. Well, it didn't say pumpkin spice, but it said pumpkin. Guess what else was in there? Salmon. I mean, anything that's popular right now, they'll put in dog food because they're not selling it to the dogs. They're selling it to the people, and they make it, you know, look like, appeal to our tastes. And it's a great marketing ploy, all this pumpkin spice stuff. You know, Febreze has a pumpkin spice spray.
Oh, they've had that, yeah.
Yeah. Everybody's coming out with a pumpkin spice cereal now, too.
So if we title this episode Pumpkin Spice, do you think it will be the most, you know, downloaded and listened to episode so far in our 20-episode history?
Probably
just,
among the—
Just because of marketing?
Yeah,
alone?
Probably among the easily manipulated.
Oh.
That's Wordle.
You know what would be really funny is if we just said that on the title and then this had nothing to do with pumpkin spice.
Too late.
So, yeah.
Too late. Why didn't you think of that earlier? We could have gotten through all this wasted time that we just had. So,
yeah.
Well, there is a reason why we're calling it the Pumpkin Spice Podcast, Pumpkin Spice Episode.
Yeah.
And that is that a little bit later we're going to talk about trends and fads and the whole concept of cool, which I'm looking forward to because...
Well, and it will be really interesting to see as we dive into that conversation whether or not this pumpkin spice thing is a fad or a trend because it's been around for a while.
Oh, yeah.
Man, people love their pumpkin spice lattes at Starbucks. I will tell you what. Man,
and there's a whole other crowd that loves to hate the pumpkin spice movement. I'm guessing.
Are you part of that crowd, Chris?
I'm on. I don't really care too much about this.
Whoa! This is the first time I've ever heard you not take sides. Honestly, you're usually like one extreme or the other. So to find you in the middle, this should be proclaimed a national holiday.
Look, I prefer my coffee black, but this whatever.
Okay. All right. Well, which that's a whole nother thing, too. The whole pumpkin spice. Beyond Starbucks, everybody seems to have pumpkin spice now.
Oh, everyone.
So, yeah. But this conversation we're going to have today about cool is important. It's not just wasted words. Cool is – I was thinking about cool all week because, obviously, if you know me, I haven't thought about cool my entire life. but I was thinking about cool this week, and cool really is – something we've got to think about theologically. We've got to think about it as it relates to our families, our ministries, the money we spend. So we're going to talk about this and how cool is understood in our culture, manipulated. I think it's an important conversation. And let's be honest, you know, just what Kenton said and Jason, what you said about the whole Starbucks phenomena of pumpkin spice lattes and how people cried over them, that's significant. You know, that's significant that these things mean that much to people and all a part of effective marketing. And I think it really does grab our hearts and grab our allegiance in some ways. So, yeah, it's a big, big thing. So we'll come back. We'll talk about that.
That would be really good.
Now, before we do that, we wade into the realm of the unknown. Today, we're not going to talk about youth culture news. We want to jump right into the cool thing after we hear from Chris and Kenton about whatever it is they want to ask us about.
Sure, let's.
This is always fun to do, yeah, by the way.
Let's tie our question for you guys into today's discussion about trends and fads and being cool. So think back, and it would probably be easy to think back maybe on your high school years, perhaps it would be a time that you might that might come to mind, but it doesn't have to be from that.
When you say that, does Kenton start looking at me and smirking like it's going to be hard for me to think back that far?
Well, it could be.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Kenton.
So, but it could be something, maybe it could be in the last year, could be last week, but something, one time in your life where you were caught up in wanting a certain trend, a certain fad, a certain something that was cool, whether that be fashion related or, something just seemed like that was the cool thing to have or do,
yeah,
or way to style your hair or clothes, something that, from your past that you got caught up in trying to be cool.
I've got mine, but I want to hear Jason first.
Yeah,
because
no, it doesn't have to be high school. It could be yesterday,
okay,
for that matter.
Okay, but both of us yesterday, threw a line out there on Facebook and asked people describe cool. What were some fads that you got involved in that you thought would make you cool when you were a kid? So we got some good answers to that. So I was thinking about it. Did you think about it, Jason?
Yeah, I've given some thought to it. So I think I have to go a little bit further back than high school. I mean, there were a ton of things that I obviously wanted in high school. I'll give you a couple of examples of following cool, which were poor examples of choices. But the first, which all of us can appreciate, Kenton, I'm not sure about you, but I know that the rest of us can, were the MC Hammer pants. and actually, there was a phase of those pants that actually had polka dots on them. And yes, I had
Let me just interrupt you. Kind of like the shirt you're wearing right now?
Nope, has no polka dots. Those are arrows, Walt.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right, I can't see. You're not wearing your polka dot shirt. That's very similar to your polka dot shirt.
Yeah, well, I was trying to relive my high school years. So.
Okay, all right. By the way, we're not in the same room. I'm looking at him over a monitor here, so
yeah, you are.
That's why I can't tell.
So, but along that same vein, in third grade, I remember parachute pants. Like, those were the pants to have, and that was long before I had my own money. And I remember I would beg my parents, get me parachute pants, and they were like $100 or something. They were like an insane amount of money. But I wanted them because I had a whole act where I would go out in front of a grocery store and I would break dance for money. And so it was a part of the act. I needed my parachute pants.
It's more of that
to
manipulation.
Be legit.
Yeah. Did you ever get a pair? Did I miss it?
Yeah. I did. But actually, I think I got the pair because I had raised money out in front of the grocery store break dancing. And I was able to contribute to my first pair of parachute pants. And I think I wore them like three times, and that's all I wore them.
Okay, I have two questions about them. One, what was the fabric? Like,
it was,
I imagine
it was
like silk or something. Or
yeah, it's like a silk. It's not like a silk. It's kind of like a mix between a silk and a, I don't know what the fabric is that you would use on tents.
Yeah, like a nylon.
Nylon?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that would be, it would be more like a nylon.
Why do I know this? I'm really embarrassed now.
You have three pairs of parachute pants in your drawer at home.
Where did I learn about fabric? I just know I'm allergic to polyester. But go ahead. So
you
that
must
was
have
a fabric.
Hated the 70s.
Oh yeah.
Man.
So I just plowed through it. What? So okay. So that was a fabric. What color?
Yeah.
What did these things look
gray.
Like?
Oh well, they came in different colors,
but
mine
the pair
was
you
mine
had.
Were gray.
Gray.
Yeah, gray. Great. And then I remember what I always wore with it was a red mesh shirt, like with the cut off. It wasn't cut off sleeves. They like just didn't have sleeves. So it just end. But it wasn't a tank top. It was just more of a shirt with no sleeves. But it was a mesh top. Like that was a really popular thing in the 80s. So you'd have like a
mesh
top. Red mesh top.
From top to bottom. Red. The complete shirt was mesh.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And a bandana around your knee. You needed a bandana around your knee.
Okay, stop now.
So to complete the look, that's exactly what you had to do. It was awesome.
Yeah.
And then every so often, if you wanted to switch to Karate Kid, you know, you put it on your around your head. So.
What year was this?
Oh, I mean, that would have been 85, somewhere
okay.
around there.
All right.
So as a fundraiser, can we have Jason dress up like that again and walk around towns and cities and stuff?
No. No, the fundraiser is we say give a dollar and Jason will never dress like that again. And we just set a bar and we yeah.
Oh, you're missing out. I actually still have some of these moves.
Do you still have any of those clothes sitting around?
I kind of wish so I could dress my son in them, but no, I don't. I actually, you know what? I do. I think I came across the parachute pants recently. I think my mom saved those. And so I think that, like, when we moved into our house here, I think that she had given me some clothes from when I was younger. And I think that maybe those were included in it.
Okay.
Actually, I'll see if I can find them. That would
actually be kind of
fun. You know, this
is – you've set the bar so high here. I'm not sure. This is just going to be anticlimactic.
I set the bar high. I just talked about a pair of pants. I don't know.
I think it was –
it's not setting the bar very high.
Actually, no, when you added the shirt – it went to a whole new level, and yeah, I can't. I gotta get that image out of my mind now. That is just, yeah. Well, I'll tell you mine. Here's mine, and it was pants as well. So, I think it was 1969, 68 or 69, and you know that was the height of Woodstock and the whole hippie movement and everything that was associated with that. And so that was when the whole, we called them back then bell-bottom blue jeans came out. And at that point in time, kids dressed differently for school. Like, so I was never really allowed to wear jeans to school. I would wear more, you know, dress clothes. I didn't wear a tie. If I had gone to a private school, I would have had to wear a tie. Which, when I was given that option, which my dad gave me a couple of times, I just said, no, I don't want to go there. It had nothing to do with the educational experience. It was all about how you had to dress. And I did not want to dress that way for school. So you would come home and you would change. And I remember I got a pair of bell-bottom blue jeans. And I think, I remember going wearing them outside. And just, you know, that whole concept of the imaginary audience? Everybody's watching you. I thought everybody would see this. And I remember the first time I walked up the street in those things, I was so doggone proud. And not a person noticed, obviously. I mean, it wasn't like I lived in the city. I was out in the suburbs walking up the sidewalk. But just trying to get the feel of the whole thing. This is great. And I remember when they did allow me, I think, to wear them to school once or twice. And I just thought, this is it. And you know, the big thing with that is, for me anyway, feeling like I was fitting in.
Okay, did these pants change the way that you walked? I mean, you felt a particular way, but did they change the way you walked? Like, did you have a whole new strut?
You know, they may have changed the way that I walked simply because they fit better than most of the other pants I had. So this was an issue for me because we would do school shopping at the end of August every year. I mean, it was a different day and age because now – you know, I would say probably 10 to 15 years after that, 20 years after that. So when we get into the 80s, boys love going clothes shopping because style became such a big deal. You know, that was torturous for us to have to go clothes shopping. So they'd drag us out. We'd have to, you know, you're wasting a whole day and you're waiting for your siblings to get fitted for theirs and then new gears. I was lucky because I was the oldest. So there were no hand-me-downs for me. I got all new clothes, but my problem was, you know, it was always in the Husky section. So, and there was you know, like in the department store, there'd be that flashing sign on the ceiling, boys Husky, boys Husky.
I don't even think they're allowed to use that term
No,
anymore.
It's politically incorrect now. But I'd have to go over there and get my clothes, and the way we did it was, you know, you would buy a couple of shirts, a couple of pairs of pants, and... Uh-huh. In our family, you always bought it a little big because you're you know, in puberty, you're going through growth spurts, you're growing those. You buy it a little big, so it's a little baggy the beginning of the year, but by the time you're done with the school year At this point, it's tight and short. So, yeah, it would change the way I walked over the course of the school year. But it was purely, it was not out of trying to put on a show. It was purely out of survival, you know, trying to walk in these pants. So,
you know, it's really interesting, too, because you bring up a point with siblings. Like siblings, the youngest of siblings end up having to follow the trends of their oldest of siblings, which are fads, which then those fads have been long gone. Now, you said you got a pair of bell bottoms in the like 69. Well, they were just kind of coming into style, so they didn't really disappear in the early to mid 70s. But imagine if that had happened like in 79 and then you had a sibling in like an 82, 83 and they were forced to wear those things.
Yeah. Hey,
that would not be fun.
I was tracking, this will surprise you, but just because of what I do with reading some of the magazines, you know, at the end of the end of the summer and the back to school issues, I think the bell bottom pants are back. I think they're coming back. Yeah. There was some,
not so much for guys, but for girls. Yeah.
Well, they'll be back for guys too. Anything to end the skinny jean thing, I think that's a godsend.
I would actually pay money to see you try on skinny jeans and see if that changes the way you walk. That would be awesome. And we can go shopping in Boys Husky. Just to bring back all the memories, all the good feelings.
I got nothing here because and this is like, you know, I imagine you in that, the mesh shirt and the parachute pants. That's a horrifying image to me. But then think about myself in skinny jeans, that's even worse. Oh, yeah. I'm not going to be able to eat lunch today. I'm skipping lunch. Huh.
Oh, are you skipping lunch to be able to fit into your skinny jeans?
I don't know what it is. What, do you guys have a fad? Chris, you're older than Kenton.
Yeah, I thought of a few. So the example I'll give.
And by the way, with your likes and dislikes, this is going to be good. This is going
to
be.
No, there's a million things I could have come up with here.
Try to keep it to one.
Yep. When I was, I don't recall if it was either second or third grade, all of my friends were getting skateboards.
Okay.
And I really wanted a skateboard. And I was young enough that, in fact, I was saving up my money. In fact, some of the money that I was using to save up to buy a skateboard actually came, you know, if you will, from the Tooth Fairy. It was tooth money, you know, I found under my pillow kind of thing. So I finally saved up enough money to buy a skateboard. And in fact, using the, you know, talking about cool, I bought a Snoopy Joe Cool. It actually said Joe Cool, you know, that's Snoopy's little kind of trademark saying there. On the bottom of the skateboard, it said Joe Cool. And I was so proud of that skateboard and, I never, of course, really learned how to use it properly, and it was, compared to the skateboards that my friends had, it was probably, you know, a quarter of the cost. It was a cheap skateboard.
But you loved it.
I loved it.
Yeah.
I was trying to fit in with all my friends that were skateboarding. That's one thing for my
Well, here's time. The thing about Cool I want to ask about. So you're saying that was like a quarter of the cost. Did you take any heat from your friends? Like, oh, man, what a cheesy thing you got there.
I think I did, but I think I was young enough that it wasn't too. I think I realized though that like my skateboard isn't as cool, and in fact it wasn't as nice. Like, you know, the wheel bearings weren't as nice and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, there was a little bit of flack from it. But when you're second and third grade, it's not as bad as it would have been, say, in middle school.
Yeah. Huh. You know, that it's Joe funny cool. You used tooth money for that because skateboards are also known to create opportunities to collect tooth money. So there's that, you know, that word symbiosis, a symbiotic relationship where skateboards make you lose your teeth.
Yep.
But then when you lose your teeth, you get money so you can buy a skateboard. So, yeah, it's that vicious cycle.
I never figured out how to do anything crazy enough to lose my teeth on a skateboard.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Yep. Hmm. Kenton?
What
do you got? This
one's actually tough for me because being the younger sibling, I was 9.5 years younger than my brother.
Yeah.
And so
it's not cool.
Whatever trend was happening 9.5 years before me,
I was right.
Is kind of what I was wearing.
Yeah.
And so it was actually, and I don't know if this is a trend or not, But back in the 90s and 2000s, like, blue jeans and stuff, they were blue, but they weren't this dark, dark blue that we have now. And so all through high school, I wore these jeans that were half, they weren't white, but they were definitely worn down to where it was like a light tinted blue.
Yeah. Like acid wash.
Yeah.
Acid washed.
And so, like, even the jeans that I have on today are not dark, dark, but they are darker than normal for me, but standard to this day. And it was not till college where my now fiance and roommate, separate people, but college.
I'm glad you clarified that, because that went right over my head. And I know your mother listens to this, so she'd be calling in and wanting you to come home right away.
Yeah, there's no cohabitating.
Right. I don't want people questioning and sending emails.
Yeah.
But college roommate and my fiance both got on my case about my jeans and saying they're not the right color or whatnot. And so it was mid college where I had to change my jeans, and they took me jean shopping to say, this is how you got to fit in with your jeans and stuff. And it was quite the heartbreaking moment for me.
That is tough when you've been wearing something all along, and then the people that love you the most and you love them say, you're doing it all wrong. That's horrifying. We need to fix you. Because that's what happens at my house all the time. It doesn't matter what jeans I'm wearing.
They're not the right ones.
No, they're not the right ones, color-wise, fit-wise, whatever. I mean, Lisa and I went out last fall, and we did get some new jeans that everyone's happy with. So that's okay.
Do you have to, like, take an army with you when you go shopping mall?
No,
it
was Lisa
and I.
You got to
take your daughters and your wife, and they're like, nope, not those. Those are great.
It was not me going into the fitting room alone. I mean, I went in alone, but I had to come out wearing these things to put on the show for Lisa, and, you know, 99 times out of 100, she just looks at you like, no, that's not it.
I fully understand.
I just thought of something incredibly fun, and we've got to do this sometime, Walt. When we're speaking together, traveling, or I'm there, you're here, we are going to take each other shopping and choose the clothes for the other person.
That's awesome.
Yeah, we'll do that.
We're totally doing this, Walt.
Yeah, we'll do that.
And we will take pictures of this for anyone that's listening to this, because
that would be
so much fun.
If there are any clothing company representatives listening, give us an email, you know, if you want to set up a sponsorship opportunity.
Oh yeah, send us clothes. Yeah. We'll wear them on the podcast. Send us clothes. That'd be awesome.
I'm still waiting for my stuffed animals.
Yeah. Well, I don't know that podcast has dropped yet, has it?
Well, it will by the time this comes out.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah. That's true. Yeah. We're waiting for stuffed animals, so Kenton's got to throw that in.
Well,
all right.
I just want to see Walt get into a pair of skinny jeans and then sit through the entire podcast in a pair of skinny jeans. That would be awesome.
I'd prefer not to see that.
See, this is the thing about cool. My feelings are just totally hurt. Again.
Well, that's a trend now to have your feelings hurt.
Yeah. Well, once that becomes popular, I'm there. I will become the icon. I will become the icon for that. Well, this is good. It's interesting.
This is awesome.
Hearing what I had. Hey, by the way, can I? I came up with a list of some fads from the different decades, and we asked people about this. So, a couple of our Facebook friends. I don't know, Jason, what you found. Bobby Benavidez, who's a friend of mine on Facebook, he said that his things were Reebok pumps. Because he thought he would jump 10 feet higher.
That was my first.
That's crazy marketing.
Pair of name brand shoes were Reebok pumps.
Yeah, yeah.
And I haven't bought a pair of Reebok since.
Yeah, well, see, when I was in elementary school, it was the commercials for a sneaker brand known as Pia Flyers. And they were supposed to make
Flyers.
Run faster, jump higher. And
that's
it
right.
did none of that. I mean, my vertical leap was still minimal. It was horrible. Bobby also said Pogs and said the Slammers made them worth it. I mean, do you still have Pogs? I mean, they're just the collection of Pogs. We have Pogs in our attic somewhere from our kids. And then he said bleached hair. Everyone wanted to be NSYNC. So, you know, the whole boy band thing. Yeah. Hey, one of our friends, Kelly Trimbath Long, you wanted to be Eminem, Ken?
No, I quickly looked up the Pogs to see, they sounded familiar, And it was another
you
toy that
I had no idea what Pogs were.
I did because I have a.
He had to look up the.
I had to look up the name.
Online.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you had mentioned Slammers, and that's what
yeah,
I had
yeah.
called them.
Yeah.
But they were my brother's toy that I was playing with, and it
okay.
was nobody else had heard of them. But
yeah.
Sorry. Go ahead.
Okay, so Kelly Trimbath Long is one of our friends here. Said these are the fads from the 80s that she remembers. Number one, big hair. And boy, I'll tell you,
oh,
you
yeah.
go back and you just, you know. Google image search 80s hairstyles, and that was, man, that was a great time to have stock in hair products. Number two, Izod shirts with the collars up, and then she's got the music thing going, Earth, Wind, and Fire, and Whitney Houston. So, you know, that's good. Hey, one of my buddies, John Bethard, he responded, and I like this. He says, obviously as an adult, John's always thinking, he says, obviously as an adult, I know that cool, at least where music and clothing is concerned, is determined by marketers. We'll come back after the break and talk about that. Social media can make that marketing a breeze these days and also very short-lived. Now he goes back to his own teen years, which, by the way, John was one of our youth group kids. So I can attest to this when he says this. He says, when I was a teen, I remember everyone wearing an alligator or a horse on their shirt, you know, Izod or Polo, and
yeah,
Doc Sider
yeah.
shoes. I hated all of it and only participated minimally in these trends. So, John really missed out on things. But did you?
Okay.
Hey,
so
yeah.
question for clarification, because I've always thought it was Izod, but then it's Lacoste, right? Lacoste.
Yeah, yeah. I know the story behind that, by the way.
Yeah, yeah. What happened? Because it was Izod. I always called it Izod, and then later on, Izod was something different than that because he had Lacoste.
Yeah.
Lacoste.
The thing. Most people don't know this, but if you Google this, and I haven't done this for years, but I remember reading this a couple of decades ago, it's actually not an alligator. It's a crocodile. And the reason for that is the fellow, I think the tennis player who wore those, his nickname was, or his name was La Croc, and so it was a crocodile. Yeah.
Oh. And so that's why they named it Lacoste?
Try not to pronounce those words out loud, Jason, because you're probably bungling it majorly.
I think
it's Lacoste. I don't know. I'm probably getting it wrong too, but I think that's what it was. Can you look that up while we take a break?
The pronunciation?
Yeah, just the whole story behind that, and you know, see what that is, because that's an interesting thing. Everybody thought it was alligators, but it was a crocodile, La Croc. Yeah. I did know the story. I forgot some of it. That's why we've got
I'll give you some slack.
Okay.
You know, when we were thinking about this in preparation, I just thought a lot about when I was younger. This would have been when I was probably in second grade, but I just remember everyone having a pet rock. I mean, it was kind of at the end of that like fad, but like,
1970s
pet rocks.
I've got it right here.
I really wonder though too. If a pet rock would really work well today, because I'm unfortunately with how aggressive our world is today, I really wonder how much that would sit on someone's desk rather than being thrown at someone you don't like. So I don't know. It's
remember 20 years ago when Pokemon was cool?
It's back.
It's back. It's now going. So Pokemon
I would say that it has been popular all through. I mean, for myself, even
yeah,
like
very fair.
All through the 90s, everybody else played Pokemon. I wasn't allowed to play Pokemon, but it was the thing to play and through. So all my friends are almost claiming that was their generation was Pokemon. Huh.
Okay, so here I went through the decades. Let me. Can I throw these at you and then we'll take a break?
Yeah, go
real
for
quick.
It. Let's see.
So just a sampling of things from the 1960s, Troll dolls. Man, those were big, and we just cleaned up my mother-in-law's.
That's another thing that had
some of those. Those are,
they had a heyday in the 80s as well.
Yeah,
so that's another
big,
thing
big
that
deal.
Cycled back through.
The frisbee got big then, but that stuck. You know, so that may be more of a trend. Yo-yos, smiley faces were really—they started to, you know, grab the culture back then. Mood rings. I don't know if you guys won't remember those, but that was a big deal. Granny glasses, certainly John Lennon brought
those.
And granny glasses, yeah. Bell bottoms, which I mentioned, afros. But here's a big one, Jason. Check this out. Hold. I actually brought a fad from the 60s with me. Do you know what that is?
Is it you?
No, look, what is that thing I just put on my desk? That's
a lava lamp.
How did you come up with me? I just put a lava lamp there so you could see that. You say, is that you? What do I look like? Is that a blob? Is that why you want to see me in skinny jeans? So the 1970s, disco music, Earth shoes. I had a pair of those. Do you remember what Earth shoes were? Do you guys know what Earth shoes were?
Please tell me you wore those with bell bottoms.
I did. They were. And the thing about Earth shoes was Earth shoes were kind of like the Kale of the 1970s. That everybody thought if you walk with your toes higher than your heels, that's a natural way you walk. So rather than walking in a shoe that has the heel higher than the toe, it was the opposite. So I had a pair of those. Pet Rocks, Daisy Dukes, overalls, painter pants. That was a big deal back then. But here's one, streaking. You know, streakers?
That really hasn't gone away.
Well, it wasn't so much a part of life as it was a novelty back then in an event. So,
yeah.
The 80s, breakdancing, that's you. Cabbage Patch Dolls, Koosh Balls, Rubik's Cube, painter hats. If you watch the videos of Live Aid 1985, especially, you know, it was over in London, Wembley Stadium, and also in Philly at JFK. If you watch those videos, you see tons during the daytime at JFK in Philly. You know, so many members of the crowd are wearing those painter hats. And mullet hair, that was a big thing. I'm guessing that was part of your life, Jason, but don't.
No, I never had mullet hair.
Okay, 1990s, Beanie Babies, boy bands, Pogs, the Macarena, Tamagotchi, the little pet, the virtual pet thing. In the 2000s, one of the big ones, the Live Strong band, you know, with Lance Armstrong's the Yellow Band. And then now T-Bowing, yoga pants, probably Kale, I'll add to that. Man, I harp on that all the time. And then hipsters, so, you know, the whole thing, just these fads. So we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the concept of cool and trends and what that means for us as parents and in ministry. So let's take a break, and we'll be right back. Here at CPYU, we want to help you help parents stay up to date on today's youth culture. One of our most popular resources is our monthly parent page. This 4-page full-color resource offers parents a timely, practical look into current youth culture trends, along with resources to help them parent their children and teens Christianly in today's rapidly changing youth culture. If you're a youth worker who would like to get this monthly resource into the hands of your parents, you can see a sample parent page and learn more by visiting cpyuparentpage.com.
Welcome back to this episode of Youth Culture Matters. We're talking about pumpkin spice lattes. Well, really, we're just talking about the idea of fads and trends. And we left the last break really kind of setting in motion some of the discussion for fads and trends in this section of our podcast. And I want to start, Walt, real quick by just looking at the differences between fads and trends. Because fad, when you think of a fad, really it's just going to be something that's short-lived. It's not around for long. It doesn't have a lot of legs. It doesn't really infiltrate many other segments of the culture. It really just kind of comes into one particular space, invades it, and then really leaves.
Kind of like a one-hit wonder in the world of music.
It's exactly. Yeah, think of the 80s. And early 90s when a lot of that happened. But trends are those things that stick with us, that are with us, that influence us, that really invade so much of our life. They have legs, and it's something that we see over and over and over again, which arguably could be pumpkin spice. It's been around for quite a long time. It's created its own space in the marketing world, which I think lends an opportunity for us to have some conversation around the idea of cool fads and trends and its influence on marketing. And I know, Walt, you have some thoughts on this, so I would love to get you going specifically with what are your thoughts around the idea of cool and marketing?
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting. A few years ago, I began to look more seriously at marketing. I've always said that the people who know kids better than anybody else or any market segment, you know, for that matter, would be advertisers, people who have something to sell. And the issue with that is that there's so much marketing out there right now. You know, kids are seeing thousands of marketing messages a day. And as we've said before, the greatest power of marketing is not to sell product, but to sell a worldview. So it tells stories. It does sell product. Obviously, that's what people want to have happen with the things that they market. They want to sell. They want to make money. But it's ideas. It's ways of living. And so with more disposable income, with an increased amount of marketing, I think the cool factor, cool has been deliberately woven in and through so many nooks and crannies of youth culture that it's a bigger deal now than it used to be, and marketers have co-opted that. Now, obviously, one place we want to send people to check out the whole concept of cool as it relates to marketing is Douglas Rushkoff's classic, you know, you can watch this online, his classic one-hour expose of teenage marketing called The Merchants of Cool. I really think that that thing is just powerful, and it's a must-watch for people. And I would say for parents, you need to watch it to understand this. For youth workers, you need to watch it to understand it. And I would say even with some of your older students, get them in the room and watch The Merchants of Cool to get them to see just how easily, you know, they're manipulated, because they are. That's what marketing does. It manipulates us into buying things or valuing things. It's even, I think, a way to promote, if we talk about it in a spiritual sense, idolatry. Whatever is cool and whatever we see as the thing that we aspire to, and we're all, because we're broken, looking for redemption, we begin to worship these things, and it can become an idol.
And I think I want to just pick up on that real quick, because one of the things, a lot of people don't know this, but I worked in advertising and marketing for years, something like 6 to 7 years of being an account executive in advertising and marketing, developing campaigns. One of the things that we wanted to do was create brands that people idolized, that they wanted to wrap their life around. And yeah. I mean, the thing that we would always say in the office was, we want people to buy things they don't really need, but they really want. And how did you do that? It was creating a worldview that was separate from the one that they may have already had, that included this product, that included the reality of this one product existing in their life. And it was something that they would need and ultimately worship, because it was something that they wanted so badly. Yeah. And so
Well, let me ask you about that. You just, because I've talked to my kids about this, the difference between needs and wants. You know, when a kid comes to you and says, I need that new pair of, you know, athletic shoes or sneakers. So, you know, when Chris was talking earlier about his Reebok pumps, did he go to his mom and dad and go, I need a pair of Reebok pumps? And kids do that. They use that language all the time. We do the same thing as adults. We think that we need certain things, when the reality is it's only a desire or a want. It's not a necessity. Yeah. We don't actually need it, but we do think that it will make our life better. Now, the wants in our minds become needs, and that's quite telling when we say that. And that's a sign of the fact that marketing's worked, because these things are sticking in the youth culture, and a growing number of kids are saying, I need that. They come up and say, I need that. I need that. You know, we were talking about Rushkoff.
Yeah.
One of the things he talks about – oh, go ahead.
Well, because you're hitting upon something. You're hitting upon needs and wants, and if you can move something from a want category to a need, that's a huge accomplishment. But one of the things that we recognized, or at least I always recognized, was a want was much more forceful than a need. There was something. So I know that growing up, you always heard, "Is it a want or a need?" And a need was something that, well, in order for life to be done, you
right,
need
to survive.
I need a new pair of running shoes because the shoes I'm using right now are not necessarily good, and I need to have another pair so it doesn't ruin my shins or whatever, right? That's a need. But when you want something, in many ways, it's much more forceful and there's more emotion in the want. And that was something that I always recognized as a marketer. Now, if you can move it into a need, it becomes something that they buy more often, but a want typically – if it's a one-time purchase, can actually move them, because the emotion involved in it, to purchase it quicker than some of the needs. And doesn't always happen, but we just recognize the power that was in that. If you could combine the passion of the want and the reality of the need, then you had a solid product.
Mm. And for those of us who are baby boomers or generations after baby boomers who have grown up in a market-saturated world, because baby boomers really were the first ones to grow up with, you know, targeted marketing moving directly towards them post-World War II. If we've grown up with that, all these realities we're talking about right now, they're not just in the adolescent world or in the world of children. They're in the world of adults as well. And for the Christian, I think we need to step back and view all these things through the framework of a biblical world and life view and begin to critique ourselves and say, you know what, I've crossed a line here and I've allowed this stuff to manipulate me more than being shaped by gospel realities and godly priorities, because so much of our consumerism is driven by this, especially as we worship youth now. And when I say worship youth, we're worshiping youthfulness, because as we get older, we want to be younger. And the reality is, you know, Lisa and I had this conversation last week. We're getting older. We're getting older. There's no doubt about that. But there's two sides to that. One of the things we say is we don't want to act older in the sense that we allow age to debilitate us. We want to maintain an active lifestyle. But at the same time, we don't want to pursue a youthfulness that is just hokey, fake, and grasping at things that will never fulfill or actually make our lives better. And so much of that, by the way, in our culture today, is really about appearance, that we come off more wrinkle-free, more stylish, more shapely, you know, that we fool people into thinking that we're actually younger than we are. And the problem with that is, you know, those of us who have watched this happen in people is, you can't cover up aging, because the more you try, the worse it actually comes off. But I want to go back to Rushkoff, right, because
please do.
He talks about cool hunters, that marketers use cool hunters. Another way of describing them, another term that's been used, is cool narcs. All right, cool narcs.
Oh, I haven't heard that.
Yeah, which I thought was interesting. These are very young, hip adults, young-looking, young-acting adults, usually typically very young themselves, who go on shop-alongs. They're able to act like kids themselves, and they work to uncover and identify the next cool thing that's out there so it can be co-opted, manufactured, and mass-marketed to teenagers. Now, a person who's done some pretty significant work on this, and I actually wrote about him in the book Youth Culture 101. I have a whole chapter in there on marketing called It All Adds Up, Marketing's Powerful Influence on Teens. Peter Zollo, who is a youth marketing expert, several years ago wrote a book called Getting Wiser to Teens, and he researched how cool works with kids. And he developed this tool, it's kind of a flow chart, I guess, called the Teen Types Trend Adoption Flow. And what he did was they segmented kids down into four types or groups who function in this hierarchical relationship with each other. So cool hunters would go to the first group. They would try to embed themselves in the first group. These are the group Zollo calls the edge teenagers, really independent, often outcasts, edgy in dress, attitude, and behavior. You know how, you know, like certain edgy subcultures, they develop their own style of dress. They start to look a certain way. So over the years, you know, it's everything from the heavy metal to the, you know, to the emo, to the, you know, alternative kids, whatever that would be, the skateboard, the kids who are into skateboarding. So they get into these kids raise themselves. Their parents, by and large, don't care about them. So when cool hunters go out on their fact-finding missions, they go to the edge kids and usually start with them, because that's where trends start. So they'll find an edge trend, and then they'll bring it back, develop it, mass produce it and mass market it to inject it into the mainstream youth population. Now, the problem with this is that the edge teens then get ticked off, because everybody who adopts it, what do we call them? They're called posers. Yeah, that didn't start with them. That's not who they are. So it's a beautiful thing for marketers, because then the edge kids have to go back and say, they stole us. You know, they stole our style. So they have to now create something new. So again, this whole cycle starts. So then when they mass produce this stuff and market it, the people they market it to are the second group in the hierarchy that Zollo talks about, which are the influencers. And this is a very exclusive group. They're the most influential student group or group on the whole student population. These are the kids who the wannabes want to be like. They're cool kids, but they're not edgy. They're big shoppers. They're concerned about their appearance, and they love fashion. They're outgoing. They're social. They're confident. Marketers, I don't know if you guys did this, Jason, but would refer to them as alpha kids or product evangelists. And these influencers, they once the marketers get these, you know, products in the hands of the influencers and they start to use it, now it begins to grab hold in the larger youth culture, leading to the third group, which is the conformers. This is the largest of the four groups. These are your typical teens who will see what the influencers are wearing, what they're using, what they're buying, and the conformers want to be like the influencers, so they're not going to adopt it. The last group Zalo talks about, these are the kids called the passives. These are typically academic achievers who struggle a bit socially. They want to be popular and well-liked, but they're pretty much too shy to pursue these ends. This is interesting. Males outnumber the females in this last group of passives about 2-1. So they they do respond to marketing efforts, but it takes a little longer. So you see how cool works and how, you know, and so the edge kids invent the stuff themselves, and then it's out there. So I'm thinking of, you know, the last 10, 15 years, some stores that would, in the mall, that would, and I don't even know if these stores are around anymore, but like PacSun or...
still around, but they've changed.
This is where they would find the edge stuff, and then they would put it out there and mass market it. There's another one. I'm drawing a blank right now, but they had it at our local mall, and it was a lot of the skate culture stuff that was in there.
Zoomies?
Yeah, that would be it. Zoomies. So Zoomie would be a place, you know, where you would see that. And I know there's other stores, you know, with that as well. And this plays really well to kids because they want to be cool, they want to be popular. And now with it extended adolescence and the juvenilization of adults, it's playing well in the adult culture. So there's lots of money to be made with cool.
Yeah. Well, let me ask this, because you're talking about the cycle of cool. And the thing I automatically started thinking about is whether or not we do the exact same thing with church and trying to boost church attendance, or rather, let's just talk about youth ministry. Because when you think about influencers, conformers, and passives, whether we like to think about it this way or not, in some ways, I think that we want to build our youth ministry. We want to get more people in the door. So what do? You send out the influencers, those that are on the sports teams, that are well-liked, that really move between a lot of groups, to then bring in the conformer. I mean, in some ways, the way that you were talking about it, I just thought that's in some ways how we sometimes market youth ministries.
Yeah, and it's not just youth ministry; it's adult church as well. You know, so much of the market-driven stuff that's happening now, and there's been a lot of criticism, and you know, some of it justified, a lot of it justified actually, to the seeker-sensitive movement and how it's been, or the seeker-driven movement. You know, I know there's a variety of terms that are used that they rely more on marketing and the draw that comes through technique and style rather than the substance of the gospel. And you know, there's also a lot of data coming out now on how that actually can pull numbers, but does it really facilitate spiritual growth? And so that's my concern with this when you talk about this, not just in the church at large in the United States here, but also in our youth ministries. And I have over the, because you know what, Jason, I was there. You know, I was there in the late 70s when I started in local church youth ministry, what's now been called the attractional model. I mean, we used that a lot, and we depended on the cool factor and relevance and being able to get kids to want to be there because this will be a neat place to be. And I think about what Duffy Robbins says, and I don't think it's original to Duffy, but Duffy says, you know, what you win them with is what you win them to. And if we win them with the gospel, we've won them to the gospel. If we win them with pizza, we've won them to pizza, not necessarily the gospel. And so I think we've put way too much emphasis on cool as a draw, as opposed to trusting the Holy Spirit to draw people to himself through the power of the gospel and the proclaimed word. And I think this will spark some good conversation after we come back after a break here to talk about some of the ways that, well, I jotted this week when I was thinking about this podcast, when we allow cool to control. Is that a good thing to allow cool to control? So we'll follow up. We'll talk about that in some practical ways when we come back after this break. Stick with us. Here at CPYU, we're taking steps to help parents, youth workers, educators, and anyone else who cares about kids help the kids they know and love navigate the difficult issues of life. We've put together a one-day training seminar called Tackling the Tough Stuff that we can bring to your community. Over the course of the day, Marv Penner and I will provide information and practical steps you can take to address narcissism, pornography, self-injury, depression, suicide, and a variety of other tough issues kids face in today's world. To learn more about bringing Tackling the Tough Stuff to your church or community, go to cpyu.org/toughstuff or call us at 1-800-807-CPYU.
Welcome back. We're having a lively conversation around the issues of cool fads, trends, and we're just going to pick right back up from where we left off and just talking about the dynamic of when cool controls. And, you know, for this segment, I'm really excited to kind of dive into some notes that I know that you shared with me around the idea of cool and relevance. And, you know, one of the words that often gets used is culturally relevant, but you and I actually use something a little bit different. And so I would love for you to start some of this with the idea of when you hear cool and relevance, what does that bring up? What does that make you think of?
Well, obviously, everybody who's marketing things or anybody who's controlling and creating cool or hunting cool wants to throw out there into the cultural soup things that we believe that if we would assimilate them into our lives, whether it be starting to do them, starting to wear them, starting to talk about them, that these things would suddenly make us relevant in the mainstream and then suddenly cool. And here's the problem, I think, in the church, because we were talking about that before the break, and the problem in youth ministry is, and you used the term, you know, when cool controls, we talked about when cool controls, that cool and relevant sometimes becomes the driving factor in our ministries, that we spend so much time, and here's a popular word, right, curating our meeting spaces, curating our technology that we use, curating our own appearance, that we think that if we curate this just correctly, and we're in style or on the front end of the wave, you know, on the cutting edge, now suddenly we're cool and people are going to want to be where we're at and be a part of our ministries. The end result of that, unfortunately, and by the way, that can work, Jason. I mean, you can draw people with that, but so can the Rolling Stones, who are ancient but still making music, and they curate themselves just right and they get people to their concerts. So you can get people there, but what happens once people are there? Are we really taking people deeper? Now, we can. Obviously, we can. But my fear is, generally speaking, that we put so much stock in cultural relevance that we spend all this time curating ourselves and we don't nurture our souls. And our ministry souls need to be nurtured. We need to be growing and going deeper in our faith so that we can communicate a deep faith. And so what happens is when cool is only skin deep, spirituality, if it's based on cool and relevance, only becomes skin deep. It's not a deep and lasting faith that gets it integrated in all of life and will really serve us well when life gets tough, and it will. You know, that's going to happen. So what I say to youth workers is, and to parents, is don't pursue cultural relevance, pursue a cultural knowledge, pursue being culturally aware or culturally informed. And what happens then is that gives you the ability to talk about things that are in the world from a biblical perspective, but it doesn't mean you have to be those things. Does that make sense? And so we need to help kids wade through this. And I think that when we're culturally informed, we then become culturally relevant, not because we look that way or our meeting spaces are that way or driving a car that's that way, but because we care. We've taken the time to listen and understand. Because what kids want, after all, is what? Relationship. You know, and relationship trumps all this stuff. Does this make sense?
Well, and it makes perfect sense. And the thing that I always, when I'm working with youth workers, the one of the things I always say is youth ministry is really spelled with four letters, T-I-M-E, time. It's relationship. It's the time that you spend with your students. It's not the games that you play. It's not the structure that you're in. It's the time that you spend with the students and diving in and having conversation and really exploring the gospel message, exploring what the relationship that we have available to us in Christ. And I appreciate the separation between relevance and of being aware or being informed. And I guess the only caveat that I would add is, you know, there are going to be youth ministries, there are going to be churches that are informed and used certain technology or certain structures or certain things in their church that may look relevant, but the end goal is not to be relevant. The end goal is they have used something in order for it to be used for God's glory in such a way that they recognize it's something that can be used to motivate others. And I think of Paul, right, in Athens. Mm-hmm. And what happened? He was aware. He was culturally aware. He was culturally informed and used the images and the idols in the culture in order to point them towards the riches of Christ, right? And this is something that you and I often speak about. And I just think that when we are being informed, that then doesn't necessarily lead us to then do certain things because we're just wanting it to see how it matches up with Scripture. Yeah. Versus when we chase relevancy, we're chasing something other than what is God.
You know,
is that a good way
of saying
that? Oh,
yeah, exactly. And what you make me think of is the pace of cultural change is so fast now. The turnover rate for cool is, you know, here today, gone tomorrow. And that's why we say things like, oh, that's so yesterday. Well, the problem is if I'm in youth ministry or I'm in ministry and I'm trying to be relevant, I've got to constantly be, you know, I'll use this metaphor, changing the paint color, repainting the youth. I'll never stop painting the youth room walls because what's popular today is not going to be popular tomorrow. And it's just an incredible time waster. And we get so wrapped up in the cycle of maintaining the cool factor that we forfeit our time spent, as you said, time, T-I-M-E, in relationship, living the gospel, pursuing the gospel in the company of kids. And and that's frightening. Just everything turns over so fast.
Yeah. Well, let me go a little bit further with the idea of cool. When cool controls, we were starting with that. So let me give you a couple of other examples, and I would love to hear your thoughts on it. So like the idea of cool and stewardship.
Sure. Yeah. So simply stated, you know, the scriptures speak to the fact that God owns all things and God entrusts things to us, and we are to be stewards. Now, we need to teach our kids that. The problem is in a consumeristic culture where we are being hit with a constant barrage of advertisements, people want us to spend our money, and kids will spend their money. And what happens is you get assimilated and socialized into, nurtured into, an understanding of life that's all about, you know, making money to spend money, and then seeking things that will make my life complete, which they never do, which means we just spend more money. And what happens is, how it's like someone said, you know, how you spend your time or what you see in your checkbook, that's an indicator of who or what your God is. And so I think these things become idols. Cool becomes an idol, and the things that are cool, whatever they are today or tomorrow, become idols. And our kids get nurtured into this, and we need to be people who steward these wonderful gifts and resources that have been entrusted to us by God and spend them on kingdom priorities rather than cool priorities, if that makes sense. So I think, you know, there we have to have those conversations with kids and ourselves as well. You know, that there's really how we spend our money, and this is something we need to be teaching kids all the time.
Yeah. You know, that's a really good point. I just think that a lot of times we're not really thinking about that, especially even when we're working with youth, the idea of stewardship and where we spend our money. And really, I even think being critical of some of the places that would you say that there's a lot of fads that happen in recent years around where you can give your money? Like, I just feel
– Oh, yeah.
There's just so many opportunities that they look good on the outside, but honestly, it's just not doing anything. So an individual gives money, they feel like they've done something, but they haven't really done anything. They've maybe have given a few bucks, but they really haven't.
Or even less than that, just hit the like button.
Exactly.
On, you know, something that somebody's posted on social media.
Or shared
media.
Something.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what's called slacktivism.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, we've talked about that before. I just think that is something that we see a lot of, and so how that can influence stewardship, I think, is something that we need to be aware of. Okay, let me ask you something else. Let's go about cool and social media.
Yeah. Well, hey, what do we want to look like on there? You know. So, and we talk about this all the time in our seminars on social media, that we create, we fabricate, we create, and we curate ourselves to get the likes and the OMGs, you look so hot, right? And what happens is this becomes
I do very often with your posts. OMG, you look so hot.
You know what? I appreciate you saying that, but in my own personal understanding of my use of social media, that is a comment I've never had. Actually, I did have it once because I was joking about that at a speaking engagement, and a bunch of people left the speaking engagement, got on my Facebook page, and did that. Yeah. Was pure mockery.
Yeah.
So I curled up in the fetal position and cried for a whole weekend. But I got over it. You know, I was able to move on. But, you know, no, here's the thing. We do this through photos. We do this through text. We curate ourselves. You know, how are we going to stand out? We ask ourselves, how are people using social media right now to get attention? And then we basically go and we work hard to replicate that. And it can be through photos. It can be through the words that we post. And we want to get people to watch us. This is what Dana Boyd, who's a social media critic who studies this in kids, calls the cycle of performance. The kids get so wrapped up in this that this becomes an incredible time waster. And it's how they spend a lot of their time. And it's a killer. It's a killer of community and vulnerability. The very thing we think it builds, it kills community because it kills vulnerability, and we can't have community, a Christian community, unless we have the ability to be blatantly honest and vulnerable with each other about the things that we're struggling with. We become ourselves, and so our identity becomes not our identity in Christ and who we've been made to be in Christ, a person made in the image of God, but what that picture looks like. You know, we do this in a variety of ways.
Well, and I think you hit upon something with the idea of vulnerability, because there is the idea of vulnerability and then there's the reality of vulnerability, right? And the idea is what we see on social media, but the reality is something much different, much harder, and it takes community. It takes your identity being in something much more than just a post.
Yeah.
That's something that needs to be taught. It's something that needs to be shared, and it's something that also needs to be experienced. And I think that it's just not something that happens as much.
We need to have that conversation in another podcast where, you know, how do you use social media to the glory of God?
That would be awesome.
I think that
would be really good.
Yeah.
Well, here's one other. What do you think about this? Cool and sexuality.
Mm. Well, I know you talk about that a lot, you know, with Project 619 and our sexual integrity initiative. My guess is, let me issue a thought here, and then you follow up on it, that whatever we see being portrayed in marketing, and by the way, you know, sex sells, and it's just we've known that for years. And I continue to look at ads and just go, I can't believe we're still doing this. I mean, objectification of, you know, females and males, that we're only sexual beings and nothing more or less, you know, that plays into it. But I think that the way that sexuality is portrayed in marketing, you talk about marketing selling not just product but a worldview. Wow. And just look at what's happened in our hypersexualized culture where there's no borders and boundaries. What do you think about that?
Well, I think I would think of the church just for a second. I mean, I think that sex sells. I think our issue a lot of times isn't that we don't talk about it. Yes, I think that there are still some pockets where it's not really discussed, it's taboo. But I also think that sometimes we talk about it, but not in ways that are really informed. They can be misdirected. They can be wrong or even deceptive. And I think that we try to counter what the culture says in some ways, but we want to be cool in the way that we do that. And I think that sometimes can be really harmful. I think that sometimes we try to make sex in a Christian marriage something that brings new colors to your sex life. So I think that sometimes we try to respond of how the culture has sold sex in a way that is just not necessarily very real. And we try to counter it in the wrong ways. And so I just, when I think about sexuality, I also think too that we have gotten to a place where we've gotten a little bit soft as well on some of the ways that we counter some of what the culture is doing. And so we're afraid to really dive into what Scripture is saying because we're afraid of offending someone. So to be that hip or new cool church, sometimes we don't even engage it in ways that would allow for us to really dive into Scripture.
And to push back on cultural trends regarding sexuality. Boy, I've been thinking about that a lot. You know, I'll tell you what's been popping out at me when I'm reading the Scriptures in the last couple of months. And I think a lot of it is where I'm spending time. So I've spent some time in Nehemiah. Lisa and I use a devotional guide called Encounter with God, which comes from Scripture Union, which is taking us through the book of Revelation right now. Great devotional guides, by the way. We've been using them for years and love them. And so much of that of what we're reading is about being countercultural, being, avoiding the temptation to fall in step with the culture. And you know, I think this applies here as well, that it's just, you know, Romans 12, 1 and 2, when you think about it, and I was reading this from the Message, you know, Eugene Peterson's paraphrase of the Scriptures, don't become so well adjusted to your culture that you fit into it without even thinking. Instead, fix your attention on God. And when we do that, that is a calling, and there's plenty of warnings in Scripture as well as examples and other issues, but places where God issues this calling. We are to be countercultural. And by being countercultural and maybe not being quote-unquote cool as the culture defines that, we actually will face a lot of opposition. And I think so much of it is we're afraid of not fitting in, and then beyond not fitting in, taking the heat that God has promised will come when we do follow His will and His way.
Yeah.
This really cool, when like we started here, when cool controls, it's costly.
Well, I think
it is costly.
You know, you talk about Romans. I think about Ephesians and the idea that not to be tossed back and forth by the waves blowing
right.
here
the
and
winds
there.
Of, winds of change,
teaching.
You know.
And by the cunning and craftiness of the people. I mean, it's these things that I just think it really. These are opportunities. I see them as for us to dive back in and really say, what is the purpose? What is the meaning? What are we going, even back to what you were referring to, what Duffy talks about? What are we winning them to? What in our church and our youth ministry? Okay, last question. Do you think cool is potentially or possibly Satan's tool?
That's a good question, and I think it is. I've thought a lot about that over the years because we're always pursuing something, right? And we have been made to be in a relationship with God. And what that, I believe, means in a broken and fallen world is we should be actively pursuing God, which means in a broken, fallen world that there will be other options, other little, you know, lowercase g gods that come along that vie for our attention. And I think that cool plays into that. Now, cool is not in and of itself a bad thing. We're not saying here, you know, don't dress totally contrary to the styles of the day. But dressing in the styles of the day when the styles of the day are changing every other day because of planned obsolescence, marketers build that in, that can become all-consuming and force us to consume even more and take our attention away from things that are good, true, honorable, and right, particularly the God who made us, the sovereign God of the universe. And so I think that cool can very easily become Satan's tool because it gets us pursuing things that lead nowhere. Yeah. Does that make sense? And so,
it makes perfect sense.
Yeah, so in the church, when we start in our youth groups or in our worship services to focus on style, and it happens so subtly, we just slide into this style over substance, you know, gospel substance, depth, spiritual depth. I think the enemy sits back and just goes, this is awesome. I don't have to do anything here. These people are doing it to themselves. And I really think we need to step back and look at that because it keeps us from pursuing things that are good, true, right, and honorable, from growing in our faith. Let me just say this. I'm more convinced of this now than I ever was, and I think a lot of it's because of my age. Because as I've gotten older, and I hit 60 this last summer, and I look back in the rearview mirror of my life, I see times and periods where I really did pursue cool at some level, and I see that it derailed me from pursuing God. And that's not to say that I'm beyond it now. I am not. I'm just more tuned into it and more aware that this can happen. And so, look, part of this is as well, I mean, and I think the young people in youth ministry, listen to the older women in youth ministry, the people who have blazed a trail. Listen to the older men in youth ministry. Listen to the older pastors, the older theologians. I think the problem with cool is that it's gone so far as now we think if someone's old, they're irrelevant, and I'm not going to listen to them. And
so
I think
true.
We need to listen because people have, the people I listen to the most are 20, 30 years older than me or dead. You know, I'm reading their writings. Yeah. I'm listening to what they, you know, sermons they preached. And I think there's great wisdom there that comes with age from people who are, for all intents and purposes, not the least bit cool. And that's not me saying, hey, listen to me.
No.
That's me saying, I really think that this question you asked is so important because we get sidetracked. It can control us.
Well, and I think, there's another dynamic with the idea of cool too, right? Like from westernized or just the cultural aspect of cool, when you talk about some of these older individuals who you're learning from, they're not considered cool, but you know, to you and I, they might be cool, but it's based upon the way that we we're like, man, that is just really cool. But cool for us meaning, man, there's some depth to that. There is wisdom in that, and it's been a change of heart. It's been a way that we look at it, and I just think I appreciate that you just said at the very beginning of that, it's not cool is not inherently bad, but it's where it directs us. Where is it taking us? And I'm just always amazed at how quickly we adopt, probably is the better word, fads or trends in the churches and in our own ministries, and what I've always appreciated about you and the relationship we share and really about CPYU and something we've done in our own ministry is we've been really slow, and sometimes people have gotten really upset with this, to adopt certain trends or certain fads or not, I wouldn't say fads, but trends. So for instance, social media, we were not the first to get on there. We were not the first to use it. We asked for a long time, how do we use it for God's glory? How is this something that is useful in the ministry we want to pursue? And I think that so often those aren't the things that we do. I think that we're not very critical. We're very uncritical in the way that we approach these things. And we're very quick to adopt, which then leads to very soon it no longer being a part of it. And I just think we've got to be aware of what's around us. And I think that going back to even Paul, the reference of Paul, you know, he used images, idols from the culture, but it also says this, his spirit was provoked, right? Like
he was greatly distressed. Greatly distressed.
Yes.
That's another translation.
Yeah.
Yeah, Acts 17.
Yeah, that's right.
In Athens.
But what he used it, but he still was distressed. And I think He used it for God's glory. He pointed back to Jesus. And I think that's something that we have a great opportunity to do, because when we don't, I do think that's when Satan is able to use it as a tool of his own.
Yeah, yeah. This is good. Good, great discussion. Yeah. And I think as we end this, you know, I'll just say this, that you know, even after this discussion, I'm not getting rid of my lava lamp, and you don't have to get rid of your parachute pants. And Chris is going to run around on his skateboard, and Kenton's going to go home today and play with his pogs. And that's just the way it's going to—
His slammers.
Yeah, his slammers. He's going to play with his slammers. So, yeah, hey, listen, I want to say this. Anybody who's listening right now and they're not streaming this from our cpyu.org page where we have the Youth Culture Matters podcast, perhaps you're doing it through another platform. What are some of those? Like, iTunes,
Apple has their own podcast. You've also got Podbean.
Anybody who's
Google,
not—
Google has their own podcast.
And we know this is being sent out through, lots and lots of these. If you're not listening on our site, it would be good for you to come and check out the page for Youth Culture Matters at cpyu.org, because everything we talk about on here, if we've mentioned a book, if we've mentioned a news story, if we've mentioned a person, we put links up for those things. So it'll give you a chance to connect and go a little bit deeper in this, especially if there's something we talked about that you found to be, I want to know more about that. So come back to our page, check that out. We always want to say that. Off the top of my head here, the one book I'll mention is one that we mentioned here that I've got a chapter in it on marketing, and this is not to be self-promoting, but the book Youth Culture 101 was really written as a book to serve parents and youth workers, to help them understand the cultural soup and help kids and themselves navigate the cultural soup. And as we've talked here today, cool is an ever-present reality in our world. It can become an idol, and we need to consciously think about it and navigate it. So that's the one I'll mention. Jason, is there anything that you want to mention?
Well, I just think, there's two, and they've come directly out of your own library there at CPYU, but I'll lean on you for some of the names, but Bill Romanowski.
Oh, yeah, Bill Romanowski's book, Eyes Wide Open. Excellent book.
Eyes Wide Open. Yep. Yeah. I instantly thought of that. I also thought of Steve Tyler's book, right? Pop Culture.
Turner.
C. Turner.
Yeah, that was not written by the lead singer of Aerosmith, by the way.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Thank you.
Steve Turner.
Yeah, that was not written by—
Yeah, Pop Culture is a good one. Let me mention one more, and it was out of print, but I think it's back in some format. But Sam Van Emmon, and we'll include a link to this, has written a great book called On Earth as It Is in Advertising. And I love that book.
Right.
I don't know why it went out of print. And I told Sam, I said, I can't believe that, this book's not in print anymore, because it was not that old. I think it's a cool book.
Yeah.
So
I think last, the PBS special that you mentioned.
Merchants of Cool. Yeah.
Merchants of Cool. It's timeless. I mean, it has
so we'll include
many,
a link to that. Yeah.
Please.
Very good. Yeah. Anything Douglas Rushkoff has done is really good as well. Well, all right.
Oh,
I think, Jason, great conversation. And
yeah,
I think one of the topics we want to come back and address, because I don't think we've talked about this yet on a podcast, is social media and how to engage with social media to the glory of God. We've alluded to it, but we haven't done a complete podcast, have we? Did we do one that you remember? We've only done 20. Look, I'm old. I can't.
Yeah. We've done some stuff about digital
kids.
Yeah, but digital kids, right. But we'll come back and talk about this, because I think for youth workers and parents, the way we engage with this is so important. So we'll schedule another one on that. Any parting words, Jason?
Well, always good to be with you. Happy podcast,
as
always.
Yeah, and we're grateful to everybody for joining us. And we will be back soon with another episode of Youth Culture Matters. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for joining us for Youth Culture Matters, a podcast from the Center for Parent-Youth Understanding. If you'd like to learn more about today's youth culture, visit our website at cpyu.org. And if you have any questions, comments, or feedback, email us at podcast@cpyu.org.